I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
Hey, what's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Today, we will be talking about Edward G. Robinson. This is a request that came in a while back from Spotify user THXCA. I wish I had more in-depth details to offer you about Mr. Robinson today, but those juicy personal details just aren't as available as many of our other Golden Age stars. I admittedly did not read his autobiography that came out the year of his death, co-written with Leonard Spiegelgoss, because there aren't that many copies out there and I couldn't find an affordable one. And producing this podcast already cost me enough money. I did find a good biography to use, though. Legends of Hollywood, The Life and Legacy of Edward G. Robinson. But most of the information contained in that book was about his career. I think Edward G. Robinson was a private man who just preferred to keep his career and personal life separated, which I totally respect. So, with that, I pieced together his life the best I could. Let's dive in. Edward G. Robinson was born as Emanuel Goldenberg on December 12, 1893, in Bucharest, Romania, to parents Morris and Sarah Goldenberg. His name, of course, would later be changed from Emanuel Goldenberg to Edward G. Robinson, so I'm just going to refer to him as Edward from now throughout our story. Edward was the fifth child for the Goldenbergs, all boys. After him, they had one more boy. Six boys. Poor Sarah probably wouldn't have minded having at least one little girl. The Goldenbergs were Jewish and spoke Yiddish in their home. Edward and his siblings also learned Hebrew, German, and Russian as children. Their culture and heritage was very important to the family, but being Jewish was not easy in late 19th century Romania. Their rights and opportunities had been stripped away, but still, the Goldenberg family was luckier than many. Morris worked as a tinsmith and carpenter, and he was fortunate enough to keep steady work. Still, there was a lot of anti-Semitism happening all over. And Edward's brother, Jack, was the victim of a vicious attack. An attack that left him with permanent brain damage, and he lived the rest of his life with emotional and cognitive challenges as a result of the attack. He ended up dying young. This traumatic incident rooted in anti-Semitism was the last straw for the family. Droves of Jewish Romanians were immigrating to the United States, if they were financially able to do so, and the Goldenbergs followed suit. They needed to protect their children. In 1903, when Edward was 10 years old, The Goldenbergs relocated to New York and settled in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Edward later recalled, quote, "At Ellis Island, I was born again. Life for me began when I was 10 years old," end quote. Let's take a little side venture into turn-of-the-century New York City for a minute, because it is the origin of many of our stars. When you hear of the U.S. being referred to as a melting pot, this was the time when most of those diverse and wonderful ingredients were being added to the big cultural pot, most notably in New York's Lower East Side. Some people ventured on to different parts of the United States, but many stayed in New York. Many different ethnic backgrounds could be found on the Lower East Side, but it was a particularly welcoming place for the immigrant Jewish community. As explained in an article by the Library of Congress, quote, "When a new Jewish immigrant first set foot on the Lower East Side, he or she stepped into a Jewish world. The earliest Eastern European Jews to settle there had quickly established synagogues, mutual aid societies, libraries, and stores. Every major institution, from the bank to the grocery store to the social club to the neighborhood bookmaker, was Jewish-owned or Jewish-run, and everyone a Jewish immigrant might speak to in the course of daily business would likely be Jewish. Even the owners of the garment factories and department stores where many immigrants worked were Jewish. For a new Jewish immigrant in a strange country, this immersion in a familiar world, around people who shared a common language, faith, and background, could be profoundly reassuring," end quote. This description makes it sound like a smooth transition, leaving everything you've ever known behind to start a new life in a new land. But although it made the move a bit easier, it was often difficult, very difficult, for some more than others. Many immigrants worked under poor working conditions and were forced to take whatever work they could find. But for everyone, it was very crowded and very unsanitary. By 1900, in the Lower East Side, there were more than 700 people per 1 acre of space. It was the most crowded neighborhood in the entire world. That is a lot of people in not a lot of space. My home sits on a 60-acre plot of land. Yes, it's a big property, but it's not really that big. This would mean, on my property, 42,000 people roaming around at all times. I really don't think there would be much room to roam at all. It makes me cringe just thinking about it. For a good visual, you can envision 1 acre of land being about 90% the size of an American football field, not including the end zones. So picture 700 people standing on a football field. It was crowded. It was loud. And it was smelly. Tenement buildings were filled with small, tiny dwellings that housed multiple generations of families crammed in just a couple of small rooms. Still, it was usually much better than where they had escaped from. There were more opportunities, more freedoms, more safety, less discrimination, and much more hope for a better life. The Great American Dream. When the Goldbergs immigrated to New York, none of them spoke a word of English. They were in a new land with new struggles yet new opportunities, and they didn't speak the language of the land. But neither did most of the other immigrants on the Lower East Side. This made transitioning to school very difficult. Edward was a very intelligent child, but the language barrier at his new school made it almost impossible for him to stay on track. He learned English quickly, though, so he was able to get back on track and excel in school again. By high school, he was at the top of his class. The Goldenbergs were not as poor as many, but they weren't exactly well off either. Still, for whatever reason, Morris Goldenberg taught his children to strive for a better life in a very peculiar way. He told them to live beyond their means, because by doing so, they had to work harder to be able to support that lifestyle. So 2025 of him. Reach for the stars, he would say. Apparently, this was Morris's method, and it worked for him, so he advised his sons to do the same. Morris had opened a candy store once they got settled in New York, and his business had been pretty successful. As for Edward, his dad's encouragement drove him to have dreams of being a lawyer. The idea of helping others, primarily other immigrants who maybe didn't have the means or ability to defend themselves, was inspiring to him. But he also liked the idea of making money, too, and being a lawyer could lead him to the big bucks. He also toyed with the idea of entering the world of journalism, this inspiration coming from media mogul William Randolph Hearst. Whatever his future held, teenage Edward was very ambitious and held close his father's advice of reaching for greatness in life. After high school, Edward enrolled at City College in New York. Somewhere along the way, though, he had grown an interest in acting. His father had taken him to the theater and cinema regularly growing up, but he wasn't one of those kids who saw the art being portrayed on the stage or screen and strived to do that himself. And he also wasn't one of those kids that really needed that creative outlet to escape his own torment. He had a pretty good childhood. The theater and the cinema was simply entertainment to him. But during his time at City College, that idea shifted. He left his dreams of practicing law behind at City College when he was accepted into the prestigious American Academy of Dramatic Arts, something he was not really expecting when he applied for enrollment. He had never acted a second in his life. One of the very first things Emanuel Goldenberg was instructed to do at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts was to find a new name, something less Jewish. He was told his chances of success in a respectable dramatic acting career would be much greater if he anglicized his name. They gave him some options, but he chose his new name himself, Edward Robinson. His acting debut came after being enrolled in the Academy in a production of The Pillars of Society. He graduated when he was 20 years old in 1913 and then went on to have parts in a couple of Yiddish theater productions. And he even produced his own show to positive reviews. Robinson's budding acting career would have to be put slightly on hold in 1917 when he enlisted in the U.S. Navy to support the country he loved during World War I. He was not sent overseas at all, something his family was very grateful for. He served as a sailor in Pelham Bay in the Bronx. He served until the end of the war in November of 1918. He said of his stint in the Navy, quote, "I can best sum up my hitch in the Navy by admitting I learned more about ships and navigation and the fleet from a picture I made later on," end quote. He said he learned how to tie a knot, and that's about it. But still, he was happy to make a contribution. Although he was putting everything he had into his hopeful acting career, Edward G. Robinson wasn't climbing the ladder as easily and quickly as he would have liked. It seemed his physical appearance was holding him back from the leading parts he wanted, not being conventionally handsome and being on the shorter side. He wasn't giving up, though. He secured a job with the S.M. Steinbeck Stock Company as a stagehand, the bottom of the ladder, with full intentions on working his way up to the top, no matter how long it would take him. Before too long, Edward was trying out and getting parts in each of the company's productions. Within a couple years, he had made his way to Broadway and was making a pretty good living as a professional actor. He immediately took his father's advice of living the high life, even if it was a bit premature to do so. As soon as he seemed to be on a good path to a life as a successful actor, Edward rented a nice apartment, bought an entirely new fancy wardrobe, and outfitted his life with the finer things. He even bought a fancy cane to stroll on the street with, because a cane made him look distinguished, and the ladies loved a distinguished man with a cane. He gave his social life a little boost, too. He socialized frequently, including a lot of courting of ladies. In 1923, Edward G. Robinson briefly transitioned from the stage to the silver screen. He had appeared in one very small role a few years earlier, but this was much more significant. The silent film was The Bright Shawl with a star-studded cast. Mary Astor, Dorothy Gish, William Powell, and Richard Barthelmess. Robinson's role was small, but the movie was positively received. Back on Broadway, by now he had become quite a big star, and his paycheck kept getting bigger and bigger as his popularity rose. His fancy new wardrobe and cool walking cane had helped him ease into Manhattan's upper society, so he was making a lot of connections and meeting a lot of high-profile individuals. In the mid-1920s, Edward met a woman named Gladys Lloyd, a theater actress. In 1927, they got married. Gladys had been previously married and had a daughter with her first husband, so she lived with them too. The new couple had a vibrant social life, and they loved to host lavish parties, living the high life. They later had one child together, Edward G. Robinson Jr., 6 years into their marriage in 1933. A happy and successful Broadway actor, Edward was convinced to make the shift back into movies in 1928 as the industry was quickly transitioning into the new world of talking films. As many voices were not ideal for talking pictures, Edward's unique voice was perfect. This completely changed the trajectory of his acting career, and he almost immediately fell into the typecast gangster roles. Warner Brothers knew they had something good on their hands, so they secured him in a long-term contract. And in 1930 alone, he starred in 6 movies. Then, in 1931, he starred in his true breakthrough role, the one that really put him on the Hollywood map, Little Caesar. As war broke out again in Europe in the late 1930s, Edward G. Robinson became very politically involved. One of the most prominent things in his political life during this time was joining the Hollywood Committee of 56. This committee banded together to work with the U.S. government in an attempt to sever economic relations with Nazi Germany as the war escalated in Europe. Also part of the Committee of 56 was James Cagney, Henry Fonda, Myrna Loy, Gloria Stewart, and Groucho Marx. In 1939, Edward starred as an FBI agent in a movie titled Confessions of a Nazi Spy. This was the first anti-Nazi propaganda film in the U.S., warning viewers of the dangers of Hitler and the Nazi Party. The movie was dangerous to make. It posed a threat to everyone involved in it. And Warner Brothers provided extra security for the actors and crew members. Not surprisingly, Adolf Hitler was not a fan of this movie. He was quite upset by it. As part of Robinson's devotion to his country and his anti-fascism ideals, he tried to re-enlist in the U.S. military in 1942 after the United States entered World War II. Unfortunately, being almost 50 years old by that time, he was denied. He would have to do what he could on the home front. And part of that was appearing in more patriotic films and portraying prominent Jewish characters on screen. He also supported the causes he believed in financially, donating over $250,000 to various political and charitable organizations. Although he was unable to enlist, he was eventually appointed as a special representative of the Office of War Information and delivered radio announcements and information to multiple European countries that had been occupied by Nazi soldiers. Robinson was multilingual, which meant his services were very helpful to the war effort in his overseas radio work. A few other notable political and activism causes Edward G. Robinson was active in was the Hollywood Democratic Committee, the USO, and he volunteered his time at the Hollywood Canteen. He even donated his large home to the USO for soldiers to stay in while he was out of town. He advocated for civil rights and fair employment practices. He was looking out for everyone. The popular gangster films of the 1930s were starting to lose interest by the 1940s, with the war consuming the minds and lives of everyone. But replacing the gangster films in popularity were film noirs. And Edward G. Robinson eased seamlessly into that genre. Most notably, he appeared in one of the most iconic film noirs ever made, Double Indemnity, with the great Barbara Stanwyck and Fred McMurray in 1944. His performance in Double Indemnity was, still is, very highly applauded. I love his character in that movie. Man, that is such a good movie, isn't it? As was the cause with many, many prominent Hollywood figures, Edward G. Robinson's outspoken activism against fascism had perked up the ears of the House Un-American Activities Committee in the late 1940s and early 1950s. Although he was never a communist supporter, his left-leaning views were enough to bring on suspicion. And many of the organizations that he had donated money to during the war were said by the FBI now to be communist front organizations. Many actors were blacklisted during this time. Many were forced to testify, including Robinson, three times actually, between 1950 and 1952. Ultimately, he was cleared of any ties to communism, but the damage had already been done. His career wasn't over, but it was definitely affected. In October of 1952, Edward G. Robinson authored an article in the American Legion magazine titled, "How the Reds Made a Sucker Out of Me." After the damage of the Red Scare and the investigations from the House Un-American Activities Committee, the roles became smaller for Edward G. Robinson. Like many others, though, he had also begun shifting over to television some. His next big blockbuster motion picture was the high-budget epic film The Ten Commandments in 1956. In the next decade of the 1960s, he shifted genres again, appearing in a series of Western films. He also did a number of films in Italy during this time. As you know, I like to focus more on our stars' personal lives than their careers. But Edward G. Robinson is one of those stars I simply couldn't find much detailed information about outside of his film career, which I totally respect. Maybe he kept his private life guarded. Again, I wish I had been able to read his autobiography, but the fact that I couldn't find more details in my various other sources about his personal life lead me to believe that he just didn't share too much about it. But I can tell you that his marriage to Gladys ended in divorce in 1956 after 29 years. It was said that the two had never really been very much in love, but 30 years is a long time to stay married for not loving each other. I'm simply not sure of the true nature of their relationship and marriage. 2 years after the divorce, in 1958, Edward married a dress designer named Jane Bodenheimer, about 25 years his junior, and remained married to her for the rest of his life. Edward G. Robinson was an avid art collector and owned several pieces of art from renowned artists like Renoir. When asked about his collection, he pointed out that he was not the owner of these paintings. He was simply the custodian of them. "You never really own paintings. They own you," he said. When Edward and Gladys divorced in 1956, he was forced to sell most of his prized art collection to settle financially in the divorce, which devastated him. According to the New York Times, his art collection was sold in 1957 for $3,250,000. Like I mentioned, Edward G. Robinson was fluent in several languages. He learned Yiddish, Russian, Hebrew, and English as a child, and he acquired French and German as an adult, and I assume some Italian since he made films in Italy. He traveled the world and immersed himself in the cultures of the countries he visited. He was a highly cultured man, and he was always striving to improve and enrich himself. A true student of the world. In a 1964 interview, when asked if he was pleased with his long and successful career, Edward G. Robinson candidly spoke about how he wished he had gone back to the stage, that his heart always remained on Broadway. But Hollywood had given him a life in which he could afford to do so much more in his life, both through money and time. He said he wished he could have returned to Broadway between projects, but it was just too difficult with the 3,000-mile distance between Hollywood and New York. Frequent travel between the two cities during the 30s and 40s was just not optimal. He further explained it by saying, quote, "An actor in London or Paris, the theater and the pictures are concentrated right there, so they can interchange their activities between the two. And besides, the pictures that are made in England and in France or any other part of the world were not as important as the pictures that were made in Hollywood. We were the market for the world. This is the place where we were manufacturing entertainment for the world." End quote. So he knew Hollywood was the best place to be for his career. Edward G. Robinson carried so many great films with his outstanding skills, but he was never awarded an Academy Award for his work. In 1973, he was honored with an honorary Academy Award for his decades of hard work and unforgettable roles. The ceremony was held on March 27, 1973, and the award was presented by Charlton Heston. Unfortunately, Edward G. Robinson didn't live to receive the honor. He died from bladder cancer 2 months earlier, on January 26, 1973. Edward G. Robinson was the second actor in history to receive the honorary Oscar posthumously. Douglas Fairbanks had been the first. Edward's devoted wife, Jane, accepted the award for him and read a note of thanks that he had written before he passed away. So he knew he was getting the award at least. Edward G. Robinson had just finished filming his final film, Soylent Green, 2 weeks before he died. He was 79 years old. And now I would like to share a few other things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. The chosen name of Edward G. Robinson was partly chosen in homage to his birth name. He wanted to keep his given initials, E.G., for Emanuel Goldenberg. And Robinson was chosen at random. He later said he wished he would have chosen a shorter last name because Robinson made for a long name to sign on autographs. Bullet point number two. Edward G. Robinson's son, Edward G. Robinson Jr., also went into acting. His career was nowhere near as successful as his father's, but he had some success, including a small role in Some Like It Hot in 1959. Edward G. Robinson Sr. was offered the role of Little Bonaparte in the movie, but he did not like George Raft, and he had vowed to never, ever work with him again after a fight they had on the set of Manpower in 1941. He had a long-standing grudge to hold up. Bullet point number three. Edward G. Robinson was the inspiration for the voice of Chief Clancy Wiggum on The Simpsons, voiced by Hank Azaria. In conclusion, Edward G. Robinson graced the silver screen with his mostly tough guy image for 4 decades, giving the world many, many unforgettable roles. But he contributed so much more to the world than his work as an actor. He helped others. He made a difference. He wasn't afraid to stand up for the causes he believed in. I wish we knew more about the man behind the image. But maybe it is by design that we don't. Maybe Emanuel Goldenberg didn't want us to know Emanuel Goldenberg. Maybe he just wanted us to know Edward G. Robinson. Edward G. Robinson was known as the tough guy on the silver screen, but behind the scenes, he was a quiet, worldly, intelligent, refined man. But more importantly, he had a big heart, a giving spirit, and he was a strong advocate for those who needed someone like him in their corner. Thank you, Edward G. Robinson, for fighting and advocating for others. Thank you for standing up for what you believed in and using your platform as a public figure to bring awareness to others. And thank you all for listening. Please don't forget to follow the show on Facebook and Instagram and give the show a positive rating and review wherever you listen. And please share the show with your friends and family. I do have a review to read you today, but it is not a positive one. But I do want to learn from feedback if possible, and this one brought up some things that I just want to provide some clarity on. This is from Spotify user Jackie29 in response to the Audrey Hepburn episode. She wrote, quote, "I was so excited for this episode. I loved Audrey since I was a child, long before it became fashionable to do so. I was disappointed with this episode. It left out many pertinent details regarding her life. Plus, the fangirl gushing, crying, and armchair analysis were excessive. A more well-rounded account would have been better. Plus, there is a lot of accurate source material on Audrey. Relying on one or two books is kind of poor effort. Perhaps it should have been two episodes." End quote. Thank you, Jackie. Maybe it should have been two episodes, but I truly felt like I did a good job sharing Miss Hepburn's story. I'm not gonna lie, this feedback really bummed me out because the Audrey Hepburn episode is actually my favorite one and the one I'm most proud of. I was truly inspired by her story. I will admit, though, I am not an Audrey Hepburn expert. I am not an expert on any of these celebrities, nor do I claim to be. I feel like we're taking the journey of learning about them together. But I do source my information from the experts, and I do really try to do a good job in bringing these icons to life for my listeners. I would welcome with open arms a recommendation of a better biography I can check out, and maybe I can do a follow-up episode to fill in any of the gaps I may have left out. I do want to remind everyone that my focus is on these individuals' personal lives, their lives away from their careers. So if anyone is looking for career stats or more in-depth details about the movies these stars worked in, this probably isn't the show for you. So maybe those are the details that Jackie felt this episode was lacking. But I'm sure there are other shows out there that can fill that void. I really, really don't recall gushing or fangirling because I don't think I've ever fangirled over anyone in my entire life. Not the way I think of fangirling, at least. That's just not me. And the tears? Well, believe it or not, I read that portion of my script about 15 times into my microphone, trying to record my voice talking about children dying of starvation without choking up. And, well, I simply couldn't do it. I broke down every single time. I watched footage of Audrey working with these children while I researched this episode, and it was beyond heartbreaking. I cried when I edited the episode too, and I cried when I listened back. I am not a crier. I mean, I don't even cry at funerals. But I guess the idea of children dying is just sad to me. I think a lot of it is because I work with small children every single day, and I love those kids so much. And while covering that part of Audrey's life, her work with UNICEF, I just kept picturing my students' little faces. They are so full of love and hope, and the idea of that love and hope and future being torn away because they didn't have the basic food to keep them alive. Well, that is pretty horrific to me. The tears were not for show, trust me. I don't want to cry on this show. I tried not to cry, but I couldn't help it. And if I listened to that episode again today, I guarantee I would cry again. I think it just means I'm human and I have a real human heart. Finally, addressing the research, I do a lot of research. Way more than I expected I would have to do, but I want to do a quality job, and I think that I do. I would love to be able to read three or more books for each episode every week, but I simply do not have the time to do that. I barely have the time to do what I do, and I really am doing the best I can. I want to remind everybody, too, that most of the popular shows that we know and love have a whole big production team. Here at Stars of the Golden Age, it's just me. I research, I write, I record, I edit, I promote, I do it all. A new story every single week, going through that entire process over and over. And I love it, but I don't love getting bashed for it. I know you all know that I'm a preschool teacher, but what I probably have never said is that I own and operate that preschool. So my 40 hours per week of school time is not it for me when it comes to work. I am running a business, a very important business, and there is a lot that is required behind the scenes of that business. Evenings, weekends, 5:30 a.m., 11 o'clock p.m. So I'm just trying to do the best I can to turn out quality episodes of this show in my downtime. And let me tell you, the podcast takes up pretty much every second of that downtime. But I am learning so much. So every second of my downtime for a product I'm sharing for free. The little bit I make on Patreon and ad revenue, thank you by the way, usually doesn't even cover the hosting fees and the books I have to purchase for my research. But it does help. You may have noticed that I don't add mid-roll or post-roll ads anymore. And that's because I'm intentionally omitting them so I can make for a better listening experience for you all. I know some people listen while they sleep, and those ads can be really jarring. And I just don't want you to have to listen to them during my show. I want it to be a nice experience. Once I'm able to do host-read ads, then I will add them in again. They will be much calmer and more pleasant. But for now, I'm sacrificing that little extra revenue because I'm thinking of my listeners' experience. I'm not going to lie, this is really hard some days, especially days like this when I'm told I'm not good at it. It's hard sacrificing so much of my time for something I'm sharing with the world for free, and then getting bashed for it, well, it just doesn't feel good. I would love to make money doing it someday, but that day may never come. You just never know with a venture like this. The negative comments do bum me out and dim my spirit a little, but then I always force myself to think about all of the wonderful ones I get from you guys every single week. When 99% of the comments and reviews coming in are positive and glowing, that's what keeps me going. And I know I shouldn't be wasting my energy on something like this, but it just brought up some things that I wanted to touch on anyways. All of you that love the show, you are all amazing. And I know in time I will learn how to ignore those negative ones. But again, I just thought I would address these things for anybody else who thinks I'm lazy with my free work. I just want to remind everybody to be patient and kind to your independent podcasters. Not just me, to everybody. I listen to a lot of great ones, and I can tell you, they are busting their butts for us. They are sacrificing time and energy to give us a free product. It's not always easy. So make sure you check in with them and let them know that you think they're doing a good job, just like you guys do for me. And you have taught me to do it more often for my favorite creators, too. Thank you to those of you that are constantly throwing out love and support my way. I cannot express enough how much I appreciate you. It really keeps me going on the difficult days. So please let me know what I'm missing with Audrey, and I will revisit her happily. But hey, at least I'm human and not AI. I really do try to do the best I can. I want anything my name is attached to be a quality product. So I will continue to strive to do the very best I can. Thanks again for your feedback, Jackie. Rant over. Don't you just love my rants? This podcast is my baby, and I'm going to protect my baby. Thank you all, whether you like me or not. Reach for the positive in every day. Be kind to everyone you encounter. Keep plugging away at the things some people think you suck at. And have a great rest of your week. For this episode, I used a book titled Legends of Hollywood, The Life and Legacy of Edward G. Robinson by Charles River Editors. An article from the Library of Congress titled Immigration and Relocation in U.S. History, The Lower East Side. An article from the USO from March 12, 2015, titled Everyone's Favorite Gangster. An article from the New York Times from January 27, 1973. An interview with Tony Thomas from 1964. And IMDb.